Hello everyone, this is Space Cafe Podcast and I am Marcus. I like it when people just get going without thinking too much, driven by this invisible force without regard for any risk. I envy them, these people who have always known where the journey would lead them, who set out like Frodo to throw the ring into the fire. By the way, I really like those hobbit cottages. Maybe I could learn something if I ever had the opportunity to sit across from someone. And hey, the Space Cafe is probably the ideal place for such an endeavor. So we went looking for a natural-born hero and found one, and we invited her. Neve Shaw, space enthusiast, science communicator, Mars simulations graduate, zero gravity experiencer, author, and very likable person. And best of all, she echoes all the thoughts I outlined in the few lines at the beginning, and maybe you out there feel the same way. In short, natural-born heroes may only exist in the movies. How reassuring, and in truth, much more interesting than anything else. Hollywood would have to invent Neve's story and mission, but Neve really exists. Sorry, Hollywood. Welcome to all of you out there. Glad you're here today, and welcome Neve, space enthusiast extraordinaire with a mission.
Hello.
Why space, Neve? Why space?
There are so many levels to that question. It's always been in my life in some shape or form. So in our house, we were all mad science fiction fans and we couldn't get enough. Our thing that connected us as a family was information and knowledge. And growing up in my era, family time was, we weren't a lovey-dovey family where there's a lot of affection and stuff. It was more about achievement and the time you spent together. It was rare because your parents were busy, but the one thing we always did together was we would watch nature programs together, history programs together, and science fiction programs together. So it was always embedded in that. And then Dad...
You grew up in Ireland.
Yeah, I grew up in Ireland, yeah, in Dundalk, which is about 50 miles north of Dublin, which is the capital city.
Okay.
And so Dad worked in General Electric, which is an American company. And so he tells us that the day after the moon landings, they were all brought to a hotel in Dundalk and a video of the moon landings was shown to them. So he had this connection with America. So to me, he was part of the Apollo program in a really weird kind of twisted way. So it's always been there. And then to me, I felt I always wanted to be a part of the space sector. But the era that I grew up in Ireland, that there was no, as far as I could see, there was no space sector. I wasn't aware of the European Space Agency or we weren't a family that could afford to go to America. So I heard of the Kennedy Space Center. I'd heard of Space Camp. And I never felt that someone like me could possibly have a career in space, but that's what I always wanted. So all through my life in diaries and things, it would be there whenever I wanted to look at new avenues for my life. But it took me to have a career in the performing arts and in writing in order for me to find my way in, because space has always been as philosophical as it has been logical. So it feeds both of those parts of my mind, which I think are equally as active. So I think that's why space.
Going back your childhood, when you mentioned you had strict parents when it comes to education. So do you think it's a benefit to have strict parents for later life?
I don't know. I think every child is different though. I think for me, that's what happened, but it didn't happen for my brothers or sisters. Like they liked space, but they were happy living a life that's considered more, you know, of the normal perceptions of success. I think one thing about having a strict childhood is it makes you work very hard and you have a very strong work ethic. Mm-hmm. And what it also helped me was, no matter what happened, the one thing I've always had is confidence in my ability to take care of myself and get myself out of situations or put myself in situations, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean. And I'm not afraid to take on challenges or learn new things. And I'm not afraid of hard work, that's for sure. But other people I've seen that doesn't work so well for. So I think it's down to the individual and
depends.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah. I was lucky. I just sort of, my confidence has always come from education. So as a child, that was mm-hmm. the thing that kind of gave me the most, it was my thing in the family that I was a good student sort of thing. So I think that's what I held on to. So the strictness of that mm-hmm. helped me a lot, mm-hmm. gave me confidence. Mm-hmm.
All this led to a career choice that led to a not so usual profession that is science communication.
Yeah.
So what is science communication all about? Why would someone choose that profession?
I think if you have this need to connect with people and you really enjoy finding ways of explaining things in a new way, I think you're a communicator. So that mm-hmm. can manifest mm-hmm. itself in lots of different ways. It's effectively a type of science storytelling, really, isn't it? So for some people, that manifests itself in movie making or in writing or in journalism or in writing research papers or giving presentations. And for me, it's manifested itself as this, because my curiosity has been such an important part of my existence and my reason to just be alive. I guess what it's fueled for me is this desire to find a whole new way of bringing science and space content to people who aren't interested. That's essentially my job. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm really trying to put space and science into society because I think that's where things will really change for good. I've done a lot of work giving talks to companies and at science festivals and family events. And in Ireland, and I'm sure it's the same in your country, you have these different weeks of the year where the government fund promoting science, technology, engineering and maths, which are STEM weeks. And I've done lots and lots of work for that. And I really enjoy it and it's great. But I feel sometimes that if it's a family event, the families that tend to turn up are the families that are already, they already have their relationship and a very healthy relationship mm-hmm. with science and curiosity. Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested to find the families that don't want to hear me.
The new ones.
Yeah, the new ones, the right. ones that don't want to hear me. So that's about re-looking at who your audience is and how do you find them. Mm-hmm. So this move to Strasbourg is a big part of that. So don't wait for people to come to you, go to people. Mm-hmm. So that's what I have been experimenting with for the last kind of 2 years.
Let's see. You just mentioned Strasbourg and you made a bold move in the middle of the COVID peak. Yeah. You decided to relocate. So why that? What happened? You fled Ireland.
I did. Well, it was a timing thing more than anything else. It was a plan that was in the making before COVID. And then obviously during COVID, everything came to a standstill. And what I realized was that my online ability as a communicator just took off, podcasting and making videos, and that was terrific. But what I found was that I hadn't really realized how much I had traveled in the previous kind of 4 or 5 years to keep bringing new content and information to people and being able to share it and figure it out and all that kind of stuff. So without that access, I really felt that I didn't know what value I had. And so that was a big reason why I said, if I base myself with a second office at the International Space University, I will work harder. I will get out of my comfort zone and challenge myself. And I will be able to meet a whole other level of mm-hmm. people in Europe and everything that will help me then make more interesting content, which I can provide across maybe more than Ireland, across different countries. So that was the ethos behind it. So the timing kind of came about because the lease on where I was living came to an end at the end of November. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, do I take another lease out somewhere else in Ireland or do I make the leap now? And financially, mm-hmm. and also just personally, I went, there's no reason for me to be here, obviously apart from family, but in terms of work, I need to take that leap now. So it just happened.
You have to go to the heart of it all.
You have to go to the heart of it all. And it just happened. The lease ending just went, well, go now. So I went right. and stayed at my family for Christmas. And then I took a month to sort of organize myself. And then I made the move in early Feb.
Let's go back to how it all started. I'm sure you have a beautiful story, an initiation story, how everything started. Because I could imagine that either you were born with the passion for science communication or something happened in your life.
So
later on.
I think, there's lots of steps. You know, it's really interesting. It's like what Steve Jobs says, you figure out your life when you go backwards, when you look at it and you can see that there's always a link. But at the time, you're lost. But one thing I have to say, even as a child, I always followed what I was most curious about. I've never been afraid to make strong decisions about my career or my life if I know that I want to do something. So I would have...
Like what?
Okay, so I studied engineering and have 2 degrees in engineering and a PhD in science. And once I sat down in my first year after finishing my PhD in a full-time kind of research role, I was like, I knew it wasn't for me. I knew it. And it's...
Seriously?
Yeah, around me, people were very complimentary of my career and people felt that I was succeeding. But to me, I didn't feel like I was succeeding because the other part of me, which is just as strong as my thirst for information, is my self-expression has always been important. I've always been a performer and a writer and a speaker and no harm, no fear getting up and public speaking and stuff. And I knew that I needed to follow that when I felt I came to a cul-de-sac in my science career. And so I stepped across. So that was a strong decision, stepped away from that and pursued about 6-7 years of full-time acting. And the more I succeeded in that, the more I missed science. And coincidentally, I was very lucky. I got to work with very progressive theatre companies and they were really interested that I was a scientist in the room and they encouraged me to respond as a scientist to different, you know, subject matter. And I really liked it. And it felt like the first time that I wasn't switching on my science brain to switch off my creative brain, switching off my creative brain to switch on my science brain. It always felt it had to be one or the other. And then I felt that I'd found something together. And it started from that. Theatre making shows that were looking at big scientific theories, like at the time, the Higgs. They were just about to discover the Higgs boson, you know, at CERN. And I made a kind of a biographical theatre show about that and looking for answers because I was looking for answers for my own life. And all through all of that, even though I was very satisfied as an engineer, very satisfied doing my PhD, not so satisfied doing my postdoc, satisfied all the time acting, but and getting very satisfied as a science communicator, I always said, because I did stand up as well, I always said, but I don't know what it is I want to say. That's the best way to explain it. I didn't know what I was really trying to say about the world and everything. And when I was making that show about particle physics, it was a very interesting theory I was looking at, a string theory, which is a possible theory explains everything that exists in our universe from the very small to the very big. And it gave me a construct to build an opportunity for myself to reflect on my life choices, like a tree structure. And every choice you make is like a branch on a tree. And I was looking at my life that way.
Like a bifurcation.
Like a bifurcation, And I was looking at my life that way. And so I was looking at, looking back at my diaries as a kid and all the things I wanted to be, all the decisions that I made and stepped away from. And the person I was making the show with, we decided to video these life choices as if they were still happening, because in string theory it says these life choices still exist. And there was the girl that, when I qualified as an engineer, my first job was working for the London Underground, so I was on the tube in London. The girl that stayed married and had kids, so I borrowed my sister's daughter because she has the same colouring as me, and I sat in their kitchen as if I was married. This was my child. I always loved the Muppets, so I have a Muppet version of me if I was a Muppet. Always wanted to do ballet as a kid, so I did. You know, I went to the ballet shop and tried on loads of outfits. And astronaut, the girl that wanted to be an astronaut, and ESA allowed me borrow a flight suit. I rang up Paris, the headquarters there in Paris, and they sent me a flight suit. And
Did you just ring them up?
Yeah, they were. I emailed them. Yeah, and this lovely woman said, "I'll send it to you, but you have to give it back to me by September." So I got one of those navy flight suits. Yeah, I got one of those navy flight suits, and I had it for the video. And all the things that I knew exactly how to make the other ones. I knew, let's go here, let's do this. And when it came to using it, I actually didn't know how to use it. So all I could think of was just lining up science fiction and watching it in the spacesuit. So that was that. So we went to shoot it and we shot the video, and I still have the video. It's funny. And the more it's going on, it's supposed to be a funny piece, the sadder I get and the more I go, this isn't a joke. I'm really not comfortable with making a mockery of something that's still in there. And I was very sad, and I was surprised at myself for somebody who, you know, I'm so strong. I make really strong decisions. I changed my life, and it was the one thing I'd never gone near. I hadn't even taken an astronomy lesson and I realized that I'd been hiding behind being busy for a very long time. And that was in my early 40s when I realized that. And the lovely thing about when you're a creative is sometimes those moments are a gift, because they can set you on a path of discovery. And being a creative, you have the opportunity to pursue it and make work from it, as opposed to, oh, that was a moment, and that you're able to just forget about it. But not only did I have it on camera, but also I knew that was a moment. I call it a moment of clarity. I knew that if I didn't pursue that, I would regret it for the rest of my life. I knew it. So I had to do it. I had to lean into it. And so I started following a NASA account on Twitter, and I found this guy, Nathan Wong, who posted about a tweet up, which were new at the time. So this was around 2011, 2012. So Twitter had just started, and tweet ups would be where they would invite people to turn up at different events and you tweet about it. So it would be like free marketing. And it was a tweet up for Yuri's night at the International Space University. And I went and I was terrified. I didn't know anyone there. I went, and it was the first time I visited the International Space University. That was 2012. And this whole world opened up for me. And so we made the show, and that was great. And the show toured. I kept thinking that this space thing would go away, and it didn't. And the next thing then, I was asked to make another show, and I had taken up a residency at this stage at an observatory in Cork in Ireland. And I said, I really want to explore the idea of a woman in her 40s looking at a childhood dream that is actually impossible, to see, just to see for myself, but also just to explore why that is and what happens when you actually activate the thing that you really want. Because I think for many of us, we know what we want it to be, but we are always afraid to go near it, because what if you fail, then what are you? And that was certainly the case with me. So I made a theatre show then in 2014 about that. And through my residency in BlackRock, I got to know people at the European Space Agency, and my skills as a science communicator started having great value. In addition to that, so I started reporting about all the different activities that were happening at ESA and making career videos and all that kind of thing happened. But also my own personal creative projects were happening. And so I made that, and I interviewed people. I spoke to an astronaut for the first time in 2014, and I made this show, and it was a chronology of the year that I spent wanting to go to space. And again, thought that'll be the end of that. And it didn't. And people were going, I expected people to go, yeah, but that's stupid. But the opposite happened. People were like, why can't you do it? Keep going. And people started encouraging me more. And I didn't want to give up on it either. And then so people asked me to tour the show. I brought the show to Edinburgh Fringe in 2015 and the Adelaide Fringe. And every time I performed the show, I had to keep changing it, because it was like the show activated my career in space and finding my own path in. And so where I had started out in the show saying that I'm never going to be an astronaut, I still don't think I am going to be an astronaut, but maybe I could be a communicator in space. And that was what kind of happened in the storyline of the show. And that kind of started happening in reality. So, yeah. And then I took the course in the space studies program. And so you go from being this person in a very small country, trying to do something impossible at an age that you're not supposed to be. You're supposed to be settled down. You're supposed to have a mortgage. You're supposed to have a family. You're supposed to be handing the mantle over to the next generation. And sure. And now I'm in a room of people who don't seem to have an issue with any of that. And my desire and my passion for space is normal. And not only that, my ability as a communicator and as somebody who's interested in telling this human side of space has this new currency and this new value. And I start getting asked to work on different projects with people. And it just grew legs. And I think it's only in the last, I think from writing the book, I've finally let myself go. Yeah, I want to go to space to be a communicator, and I want to share that perspective of space. And that's really what I'm up to.
Fascinating. Yeah. So,
but it didn't happen overnight, yeah. Marcus. It was a very slow, I wouldn't let myself want something that
fermentation.
Big. Yeah, fermentation. And also in Ireland, we would be modest about wanting too much, you know, and who do you think you are getting notions? So I had to overcome all of that as well.
Fascinating. I would call it not only fermentation, but also serendipity, because I feel like you were ready to take leaps of faith to just let yourself fall into the next place and not overthink things. So I was hooked when you mentioned some people hide behind business. So do you think that what you're experiencing or you experienced is somewhat a lot more along the lines of real life, so whatever the real is, and that the social structures that we believe resemble real life could easily be overcome, and underneath there is another life that makes us a lot freer? If we're just ready to allow ourselves to see that additional level. So are we locking ourselves up in something that's not so important, in fact?
I would hate to speak on behalf of other people, because I think we all have our burdens and we all have responsibilities and we have different values and different priorities. I think if you have a family, your priorities change no matter who you want it to be. If you need to support people, there are different priorities. So it's kind of the way life happened for me. I could easily still be married and have had a family, but that just didn't happen to me. Mm-hmm. And I think deep down, that's not what I wanted. I think I knew that's not what I wanted. So I think I kind of self-sabotaged, but in a way, I think subconsciously, I always knew what I was doing. But I think certainly for me, it was always there. And it was this notion of, is it possible that someone like me could have a life like that? Because to me, it felt like someone like me would never have the life that I saw other people have, like astronauts or people who are explorers, people who go off and they... I think it's the exploration part of, I think, is the constant for me, the people I admire. There's an Irish guy who was key in the Shackleton era of exploration, and his name is Tom Crean, and he's a massive hero of mine. I think I look at him, and he was just a simple farmer from Kerry, and I'm always going, how did he do that? And he just kept slowly beavering away in the background, but he was true to himself. And the one thing I think, it's like I said earlier, the one thing I have to say that's always been constant for me, no matter how hard life has gotten for me, my curiosity has, I've always believed in it. I've always listened to it. And I get this little kind of pang of excitement when somebody says something to me that matches that curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I try to listen to that. So unraveling yourself from the busyness was the hardest part that I needed to do. So I came back from the space studies program and I changed, and I knew I changed, and I was in a I was in a long-term relationship with a lovely guy, but I knew I knew the change was coming, and I tried for a year not to make that change happen, but we both knew it was inevitable. So we wrapped that up, and he was key.
Because you were on a different mission.
And he knew it, and I knew it, and he's a very generous person. He knew exactly, and he would have the same kind of ethos about what life's about. And then I went on a simulated Mars mission, and that was the last key for me about changing your life to embrace this quest. Mm-hmm. So when, you know, you live in a confined space and you realize you need mm-hmm. nothing, I went back to the same apartment, which I've now given up the lease on. And I went, I don't need any mm-hmm. of this. I don't need any of it. I don't need any of it. Mm-hmm. I just need my camera. I just need mm-hmm. money in my pocket. And I just need to be in the right place and I need to pursue this. Mm-hmm. So since that, and that was 2017, it took me 4 years, mm-hmm. 4.5 years to downsize everything. So the Strasbourg move has been the final part of that. 6 months before I left, I started giving away all my possessions. And now I just have a few boxes of storage of archives, like papers and just trinkets and different things that I've kept for my life, but nothing, a tiny little unit. It's 50 meters. So yeah.
So what matters in life? So it's obviously not the material world in your case. So what is it that you're carrying around with yourself? What matters to you?
Connecting with people is a massive thing for me. My being authentic. And I think leaving a mark, I think that's what it is for me. I have to leave my mark. And I think for a lot of people, that's possibly children. So I think maybe it's mm-hmm. that because I didn't have kids, maybe that's not being fed. Mm-hmm. But I need to leave my mark. And I think mm-hmm. the artistic part of me has always been drawn to that perspective of seeing the earth in its entirety. I think it has a massive mm-hmm. potential to change the way we see ourselves and the way we treat our planet. And I hear that again mm-hmm. and again from astronauts. But I think it's back to what I was saying before in science communicating. When I turn up at family festivals and stuff, they're not the people I need to tell. They know that. It's the people that don't want to meet me. They're the people. So that's why I'm leaning in to that. So I don't preach to
the converted.
Yeah, there's no point because they're on it and they're with me. So there's no point. I know there's lots of people that are like me that are probably far worse off than I was, because at least I had the freedom to do it, who I hope by meeting me or chatting with me or hearing about me might make them go, that's mental that someone like that wants to be a part of space. So it shakes mm-hmm. their thinking and their perspective of what reality can be. And mm-hmm. Everything I do about people is to find out what it is that they're most curious about or most passionate about, and have mm-hmm. conversations that they tell me something that they're really fascinated about. That's what I want. Mm-hmm. That's what I want. Mm-hmm.
So is your plan of, or your dream to go into space and take a look at the pale blue dot, is that still on your bucket list? Or just let me turn it around. Do you want to do that for yourself, or do you want to do it to intensify the way you communicate about science to the world? And because like we're in a very critical moment in time, in a positive and in a negative way. So this is a very special moment we're all experiencing. So where things could turn to the better or turn worse. Yeah. So the jury is still out. And so what is your role in all of this?
It's about, so if I just go up, it's pointless. Absolute waste mm-hmm. of people's time and money. It's just another person that wants to go to space. There's no value to, I don't see it. I think it's, for me, it's egotistical and it goes against my own values. There has to be a merit in it. I have to earn it. And I have to represent millions and millions of people in order to do that. So every conversation that I have, every time I get up and speak, I have to find the people that don't want to hear me, because it's them mm-hmm. that have to come with me. So the plan mm-hmm. is to connect with people. I'm doing this kind of walking mission, and the plan is to use it as a way to reach out to new communities of people, talk about myself and hear about them, and make that genuine connection, ask them to commit to me in some way by email or putting their name on the thing. And what I want is, Marcus, that they meet me. And this was before the world closed down. It was this notion of this traveler who came to town with a sled of everything they own mm-hmm. and a piece of outerwear that's like a, it looks like a spacesuit. It just looks like it doesn't belong. And mm-hmm. I go to the local town hall and I talk about myself, but I also talk to them about, like, why don't you care about science? What is it that we're getting wrong? So we have that conversation. And so they meet me and they go, she's mad. Like, she's mad. And they leave it. And then maybe 2 or 3 years later, in that small town, they're having their dinner and they put on the news and they see that that mad woman has managed to get to the International Space Station. So now those people have connected with me in a new way, so that when I return back down to Earth and I go back to the same town and they go, you did it. And I, yeah, I know, I told you I'd do it. Like, and then I go, so you said you were going to do this. So what are you going to do? So it's about shifting permission around the boundaries that you decide life is about. So it's like you decide your own perception of reality. So I am asking you to make sure that you're happy with your with the limitations that you've set yourself, because they're all in your head and they can change in a heartbeat if that's what you really want. And so if you start thinking about it, you can start activating it. And so that's why. So it's the part of going to space isn't the end, it's the beginning. So if I then have all these people that I've met and I've connected with, when I see the Earth from a distance, they're all listening for the first time instead of the people that are already invested. There's a whole new audience now watching. And I will not be a brave passenger. I will not be as fit as astronauts are. I will be afraid. I will probably be sick. I won't be well, but I'll give you the genuine reality. And it will remind people of the vulnerability of humans when they're taken off this planet, and how important it is for us to remember that we're part of Earth and everything else is a ticking time bomb in terms of survival. So it's all of that.
So when will you be launching?
I don't know. I have to walk a long way and I have to talk to a lot of people. But getting to Strasbourg is a big part of that. So I started my walking mission just at the start of January. I just went, I can't wait anymore for the world to open up. So I'm going to start walking every day and live streaming. So I started that in Ireland and I will continue it when I can come out of quarantine here and connect with people virtually. And that will be my currency. And for that to become, if there's a list of people, when they eventually decide whether it's the European Space Agency or another private company to go, we have to send a communicator in space, I have to be on that list.
So tell me, what does a typical walking session look like? Perhaps if you can give me an example where it turned out especially strange or especially positive. So tell me, give us an insight.
It is literally, you walk out the door. And you say, I'm going to walk for 2 hours today. I'm going to clock up a number of steps. I'm trying to make a kilometre, where a kilometre is a step. I'm trying to get to the moon in one leg. And the idea always was to do one of those legs in a different country around the world. I'm just going to walk. So I was staying in my brother's house and he lives in the country. So I said, I'm going to walk for 2 hours and I'm going to clock up some steps and I'm going to live stream and people are going to join me. So I would go live and I would talk about what I want to do. I would I talk about space news. People interact with me. I ask people what they want to talk about. At the moment, a lot of people want to talk about mental health. They want to talk about, you know, what they're doing. I'm encouraging them to tell me about what's happening where they are. And so it actually just becomes a really normal conversation. And there's people that are stuck at home. And I tell them, get out and walk with me or just watch me. So most of the time the camera is on the road and then the odd time it comes back to me. It depends on what I'm trying to do. And that's all I'm doing. That's all I'm doing, because I believe you start small, because I've always felt like I call my project Walking Slowly to Space, because for me it's about the pilgrimage. It's about, as explorers, we always want to know what's over the hill. And we began as walkers, as humans were walkers. And it also goes back to this TED talk that I gave in 2014 when I was at that pivotal moment making that first show. And I was looking at the time about, I was really trying to change my perception of reality and why people tell you what success is and how dangerous that is and why you need to figure that out for yourself. So I looked at what failure was defined as in the dictionary, and it said an absence of success. And I was like, God, that's really mad. And so I saw suddenly that success and failure were the two things. They were the opposite end of the two things. And I realized that failure is literally doing nothing, but succeeding is doing something. Just mm-hmm. keep doing something mm-hmm. every day.
Sure.
And so that's why.
Sure. So tell me, what does it take to ideally finally make it onto a spaceship and launch at some point? So what do you have to do? Who do you have to talk with? You can either be the daughter of a billionaire who by chance owns SpaceX or whatnot, or you could be like you and myself, a person, a random person on planet Earth. So what does it take to make it onto a spaceship?
For me, my terms are to connect with millions of people. I don't want it mm-hmm. unless I've connected, unless I've done the groundwork. Mm-hmm. So I have to do about 2 to 3 years of groundwork. And they are my currency, and they are the people that are mm-hmm. going to help me get on, because they're the people that are going to, by having that yourself, that currency now, that online currency and right. and people behind you, that's what so I believe will help me.
So you could say, hey guys, hey Jeff, hey Elon, yes. hey whoever, I have 100 million followers. Do you want me on board?
Yeah.
So yeah, that, okay.
that's pretty much it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Or even more significantly, for the space agencies to reflect on the value of a communicator in space, mm-hmm. which is really mm-hmm. the absolute ideal. Mm-hmm. Because I think what NASA tried to do back in 1986 with Christy McAuliffe was so right, having mm-hmm. a teacher in space, mm-hmm. taking somebody from mm-hmm. the community. So I think either of those I would gladly take.
What do you make of Elon Musk's recent news about
bringing a
crew of civilians into orbit? So what do you think about that?
I think it's great, but I think for what I'm trying to do, I think it will have no impact. I think it's only news to people that are in the space world. It will have no... People, for 95% of the world population, they won't even know that's happened. That's what I think.
Yes,
and I think that point. Inspiration is great, but you've got to make sure... You can't just inspire people that are already inspired. Who are you inspiring? Why are you inspiring? And what are you trying to say? Mm-hmm. And just having the money to do that will not necessarily inspire people. You're only just, you're all in a vacuum and in a bubble, a space bubble. That's what I think.
I just opened your website and I find your publication, Dream Big, very prominently displayed right in front of me. And so it's, I think it's a manual for everyone to read when it comes to pursuing one's own dreams and letting oneself or allowing oneself to pursue one's own dreams. Who would benefit from it?
I think it appeals to non-space, non-science audiences, probably even more than space audiences, because I think space audiences understand what that dream is. And so we're all suffering the same desire. But I think for the general public, I think that it's very interesting that somebody who, the least likeliest kind of person who can get to space is devoting the rest of their life to that dream. And I think I'm very honest in it. And I try to share exactly what's going on in my head and how afraid I am all the time and how I'm worried about money most of the time, because I think they're very honest realities for most people in the world. So I think it's more for the general public just to think about, have you got some sort of desire or some gnawing thing, some unfulfilled activity that just won't go away? I guess I would hope that my book would make them realize, yeah, just get over yourself and just start. That's what I want.
Is there some kind of secret sauce behind that you're ready to share in that book, where, because people are looking for whatever kinds of codes or secret sauces or manuals or blueprints to relieve them from their issues? Would that be the approach you're taking, or would that be the false image read into that book?
I wouldn't feel that I am wise enough to give anybody a manual, because I'm just about fumble through my own, Marcus. Mm-hmm. But what I do probably say to people is, don't be afraid to be vulnerable, and don't be afraid to tell people who you are, or who you want to be, because I think most people like to help. That was the thing that I couldn't get over. Most people just want to help you along the way. And if there's any nugget of wisdom from what I've learned so far, it's about that. For me, it keeps going back to perception and perspective. And I think that's why space keeps pulling me in when I started reading more and more, you know, about the scale of the universe, our place in the universe, and reminded myself of all those cosmos episodes that Carl Sagan made. We're so small on our own, but together we can do incredible things. And
sure,
I moved around a lot as a kid, and I think it helped me, it made me braver because of it. So if you think about it, when you're a baby, your universe is your parents, basically. And then when you get a bit older, your universe is your house, and then it's your friends, and then it's the town that you grew up in. And then you go to college, and then it's the city, and you look back on the town, and it's very different. And you keep doing that with space is the ultimate experience of that. So by seeing the Earth in its entirety, astronauts will tell you that they suddenly see their place in space in a completely different way. And so you can apply that to, I think, everyday life. Like, you decide for yourself whose opinion you care about, who are you living your life for. And so you have to find your why, you have to find your just cause. And I think that to me is about those conversations, to find out what people are curious about. To me, that's their just cause or their passion. Like Simon Sinek goes on about your just cause or your why. And I think if you spend the time trying to figure that out, I think you just naturally ease into the life that you really want. And sometimes society can make you feel that you don't have permission to live life outside the social norms. But I would say just go find your tribe. They're there. Because if you think it and you want it, you can be sure somebody else is thinking it and has it.
What do you tell people who would perhaps rightly say, don't we have grander problems than space travel right now on Earth?
I worry a lot about our planet, and sustainability would be a big part of the message that I try to give with space. Because when you survive, when I was on that simulated Mars mission, when you suddenly have rationed water and rationed food, your whole perception of what luxury is changes, and you value objects and things very differently. And it set me on a course about realizing these amazing lessons that we can learn from space and how we can use them back on planet Earth. So I think that Earth observation, and I think that that perspective of space, if it's communicated properly, has a huge value in bringing people closer to owning climate change on a personal level, instead of feeling that it's something that's happening in the polar regions and it's something outside of themselves. So that's where I think space has a value. I think that space has always given us new products, new technologies that we've applied down to Earth. And I think as a species, we've always been explorers. So space is just the next frontier. But before that, it was the Arctic regions and the Antarctic regions. And before that, it was the voyages of the Middle Ages and countries discovering other countries with other populations and cultures. So for as long as we've been alive, there's been two constants. One is that we've looked up at the skies for answers. And secondly, we've always wanted to know what lies over that hill. So I think it's a fundamental part of what it is to be human, is to know more and to explore. And yes, there are more important problems, but I think if we don't keep exploring and trying to understand our place in the universe, I think we stop trying to understand who we are as humans and what is our place in all of this. So it's as deeply philosophical as it is about technological, in my opinion.
So you've been traveling far and wide, preaching that gospel to your audience. So what do you think, what is the state of science in society these days? What's the role of science?
I think we have a lot of work to do. I think that there's only a small percentage of people that feel that science is speaking to them and that they have the right to have a voice in it. And I think that if we are really going to become this culture, this equal culture, then we have to do better in explaining science and making it relevant to society. And I think it's deeply rooted in the Sustainable Development Goals as much as any other topic. But for some reason, science has been elevated and has become like a gospel, and and people bow down and listen to scientists, and that's great. But I would also like to see everybody having a say.
Engage,
having a say, having an understanding, mm-hmm. and questioning and going, well, hang on a second. We tend to just step away when a highly qualified person steps forward, and rightly so, you know, that they deserve that praise. But at the same time, there's this massive knowledge gap between the people that know and then the people that don't even know what they don't know. And mm-hmm. I feel mm-hmm. that's not right. I don't think it's equal and I don't think it's fair. Mm-hmm. So as a science communicator, it's our job to bring that knowledge to in such a way that makes sense and is applicable to people in terms of what their interests are mm-hmm. and what their values are, and then let them decide what they want and what they don't mm-hmm. want. But mm-hmm. by keeping science where it is, using dense language, and mm-hmm. it is it's exclusive, it's elitist, and mm-hmm. It's intimidating. And so we will never change as a culture or as a society if we keep it that way.
Wonderful. Niamh, let's talk about your experiences, your very concrete experiences you've already had. So you already mentioned the Mars simulation. So how was that? How did that feel? Can you take me by the hand and walk me through such an experience?
Yeah. So firstly, I'm not the person that usually goes on those missions. So I've met people that do them all the time and they're so good at mm-hmm. it and they're so capable and they can take it all mm-hmm. in their stride. So again, I experience these things with a set of eyes that are honest and vulnerable on purpose, because I want non-science people or non-space people to put themselves in my place and go.
Sure.
So I try to experience them with as much honesty as I can. So I got involved in the Mars mission at the Mars Desert Research Station after I completed the Space Release Program in 2015. And some of the participants would be very experienced in the field, geologists and astrobiologists. And they put in a call for a crew, and they were looking for an artist and a communicator. They wanted to do a big outreach project on it. So I said, yeah, I'll do that. We got accepted, and I was like, oh, Jesus, we're doing this. Okay. I was like, so firstly, I didn't know how I was going to afford it, because it's not that much. But like, when you're a science communicator, you're doing it more for the love of it than it's not the most sure. financially rewarding thing to do. So I was like, okay, I'm doing this. So again, I just walk forward and I have no idea when I start how it's going to happen, but I just go with the flow. So I afforded it and it was fine. And I remember being given an email with this massive packing list, and these would be things that geologists and astrobiologists would have all the time, like a decent pair of hiking boots, you know, a sleeping bag, really simple things. But I had to go and buy the whole thing, the whole gamut. And I was like, okay, do I get camping socks? Do I get, like, what do I get? Outerwear. And I had no outerwear and everything. So I went, and I knew three of the crew already, and then the fourth guy, we had been talking together on WhatsApp as a team. And so got the flight, got a bus from Denver to Grand Junction, which is where you meet when you go into the Mars Society facility there in the Utah desert, and met the rest of the crew, and we hired a four-wheel drive, and we go to Hanksville, which is this tiny town, and you wait for the previous crew to meet you. We were crew 173, and crew 172 met us. I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. I went, oh my God, what am I doing here? I realized.
So how long was the whole thing going to be taking?
Not long. It's only like, so I would have left Ireland. I think I left Ireland, I think around the 10th of January. And I was back in Ireland on the 5th of February. I know that because it was my birthday. I got back on the 5th of February. So the mission itself.
So it was just 2 weeks.
2 weeks mission. 2 weeks mission. But it changed everything, because.
I mean, like, that sounds like it's doable.
Oh, it's very doable, but it's really hard. It's really hard. And I want to do a longer one I'd be very curious to see how I survive. But it's like when you experience something for the first time, Marcus, it's like time slows down and it's like, whoa. And when we met crew 172 coming before towards me, they looked so tired and dirty and broken. I remember going,
after 2 weeks.
I said, what have I done? And the guy, Patrick, he was the green hab officer, which is the guy that takes care of the greenhouse. And he drove us, and we had two cars, and the other car went in. And I just stuck close to this geologist and the astronaut, the two lads. I just felt safer with them, and I just stuck to them like glue. And he just kept telling us about all the things that went wrong. The water pipes froze when they were there for 4 days. So they didn't have water for 4 days. And like, mm-hmm. I was like going, okay, yeah. And they kept asking us about the food that we brought in. And I was like, and I didn't know if there was going to be some sort of weird coup or something when we got there, right, because we would be in the middle of nowhere and anything can happen. But thankfully, they were lovely. That crew were really nice. And they left, and suddenly this was my world. And I was amazed how quickly I adjusted to this being my world. We took it really seriously. We didn't contact anybody at home or anything, and we did the full sim. Like, every time you're outside, you suit up and you use the radio.
So how many people, what was the crew size?
Five. It was five of us. Okay. And you have to at least two have to stay in the hab in case of emergency, and you're in radio contact all the time. But like, even suiting up takes ages. The helmet is really awkward. You get all this chafing. The backpack, this is all kind of custom made for the facility. It's not real. It's just a nod to an actual spacesuit. Mm-hmm. So this is what it would feel like. It's incredibly heavy. Your center of gravity is off. All of your senses are down. The stupid thing keeps fogging up, so you can't see in front of you. Mm-hmm. It's all scratched. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to drive this bike, the ATVs. And like, you can't even sit in it. Like, you're sitting forward like that. And my job is to keep everybody with GoPros and cameras. And so I'm like, from 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm setting up GoPros. People are going, Neve, I want a GoPro. And so at the end of the day, I have to take all the GoPros back. I have to take all their data and download it onto a hard drive and recharge them all, clear them. And then I also have to pick pictures, do a report every day. And then I really wanted every day to communicate with Facebook. And so then I have to take images, and you have to make them really small because the bandwidth there was a joke. So I'd be going to bed at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and I picked the dud room. I picked the room because the heating is a propane heater. So it's this constant gas heating at night because it was the desert and it was cold. And there was no real kind of ventilation in my room. And I was sleeping up in the top of this kind of box. I never slept a wink because I'd be like, I was quite chronically thirsty and there was no fresh air. And I got really bad headaches when I was there. And you're just like, you're punch drunk, and the pressure's on to stick with the experimental protocol and to help everyone and to stay in good form and to stick to the rota of when it's your turn to clean or to make dinners or to make lunch. And that seems like nothing, but believe me, it just occupies your whole world. And in a very short space of time, you're completely connected. And if anyone is off, you just know that there's a vibe. Wow. And then you're going, and like, how do you bring the crew back together again?
I was just going to ask, how did you get along with the crew? Because usually in science fiction movies, they start killing one another. So how'd you get along with the rest of the crew?
Very well. I, as an Irish person, laughter comes very quickly to us. So, and I think from moving around a lot, I'm pretty good at figuring out how to get on with people. And so our toilet blocked the first few days that we were there. So
there was one toilet.
Oh, yeah. And it's not even a toilet. It's disgusting. So nice.
A toilet shower.
Yeah. So you have... No, I didn't show... We didn't shower. Well, there is a shower, but I think we had a shower like for 2 minutes because it's so cold and dirty. There's red muck everywhere. So you're given these two big massive plastic drums of water, and that's it. And so that then... You connect that up to an external pump that feeds to like a cistern at the top of the building, and you have to pump up every day and make sure that it stays at a certain level. And then there's a really bad...
It sounds like fun.
There's a really bad pump from the cistern to the taps in the greenhouse and in the kitchen and in the toilet area. So every time you turn on the water, it goes... right? So you know... If somebody has flushed the toilet, if somebody's flushed the toilet, and we only flush the toilet for number two, we'd only flush the toilet for number two, so then you'd know, oh, what's his face had a poo today? And you got to know everything about everyone. But anyway, so the first few days, the toilet blocked, right? So you can't poo, okay? But you have to. I held it in for the first day, and I was like, I have to poo. I have to poo. I can't. I have to poo. And so I was like, okay, what do I do? And I said, it has to be a plastic bag. So I went down to the toilet, I pooed in a plastic bag. And you have to move your body, because that's actually a really hard thing to do. Like, how do you hold the plastic bag? So anyway, so I did it, and it was embarrassing. And it was really, the bag, it was just so smelly. I couldn't get over. I kind of bagged it in three bags, and it still reeked. And so I had to ask, like, where are we going to put these? What are we going to do? So the conversation had to come up. And so I just went for it. And I only knew these people. Like, we all did the Space Studies program, but we didn't really know each other at that stage, like at that level, the way you'd know your family. But we had to. So I said, okay, sorry, what are we all doing? How is everybody pooing? What are we doing? And so everyone was like, well, I haven't pooed yet. I have. What have you done? Awesome. I do this. And we all started exchanging stories of
how you get very close pretty quickly.
Yeah. And you start laughing. And I started making jokes. And it was, we were a team that laughed our way through any problems or struggles. So if anyone was having a bad day, it just got surreal. So we go surreal and we just start laughing maniacally, and it would just dispel the tension. And but it was very tough. There were some days it was very low, even just 2 weeks. It's mad. 2 weeks. And it changed everything. I've never seen my perception of natural resources never changed. Like 3 years later, I downsized my life based on that. Just 2 weeks. It's mad.
Cards on the table now. You get a call if you want to be on the first Mars mission after that experience, but you will still want to do it.
Oh, yeah. But I have to come back. It's about sharing the experience, because it's not about my experience. It's about talking about it, or writing about it, or videoing it. So coming back is a massive part of it. So yeah, absolutely. I'd go in a heartbeat. Yeah.
So
yeah.
As long as the toilet works.
Well, I like that, because that's what it would be like. So what I really liked about the Mars Desert Research Station is that it's more than 20 years old, and things don't work. And you forget to charge things, and you forget, like, we had all these great plans. Our two main experiments was one that we had a modular brick that would be, it was a proof of concept for building walls on Mars, so that you would 3D print these bricks. And there was two segments to it. One was for soil or regolith, and the other was for water, because water is a great insulator. And so we had, the lads that had worked on it, they had figured out that we should be able to print at least 17 bricks using the in-house 3D printer. No, not 17, 47 bricks, I think it was. And we printed one and a half bricks, because everything that you could imagine that could go wrong went wrong with that experiment. And that's life. That's
completely failed.
That's but that's what would happen on Mars. And that's what happens in science all the time. And what I find is that in a lot of these missions, people feel the need that they have to talk about the positives. But actually, I think non-science audiences and non-space audiences, they can connect far more when you talk about the stuff that doesn't work and your fears and how rubbish you are. And because everybody understands what it's like to be a human and struggling. So I share those stories in the book. Definitely.
Fascinating. So would you consider the Mars experience, the Mars simulation experience, as one of the most compelling and most fascinating experiences in your life when it comes to experiencing space situations? Or is there another one?
I think the
zero gravity flight?
Yeah, that was brilliant. That was great. Again, I'm just always scared, Marcus. I just live in fear every day. And I just keep putting myself in these situations to go, what are you going to do? And I go, oh God. Because everybody, again, I went on that, and everybody had the plasters for the, you know, the way you could, you know, so they tell you to go to the doctor and get this prescription for this plaster behind your ear to help you with your motion sickness. And I just was, I can't afford to go to the doctor to get a plaster. Like, I can't do that. And
I can do it without.
I'll do that. And I went, what if I vomit? And so I set up the GoPro at the back, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I really didn't know what was going to happen. And I just went, if I vomit, then there you go. That just shows you again how vulnerable we are and how amazing astronauts are, that they never tell you how awful they probably feel most of the time that they're in space. So again,
but you weren't alone on that plane. I mean, like, if you vomit,
they push you to the front.
That's a problem for the others.
It is a problem for those, and it's really unpleasant. And everybody that vomited, it really wasn't pleasant for them. So I went, right, if that's what's going to happen, that's what's going to happen, because that's probably what's going to happen to me on the International Space Station. You know what I mean? So I was curious to see, I think I'm always just curious to see, okay, Niamh, you're making a big talk. Let's see what happens when you walk the walk. And I was curious. And so I gave myself permission. If you vomit, don't worry about it, Niamh. Just, you have to admit that you vomited, right? So, and I didn't. But I was, but it was amazing how much of a safety girl I was. So if you look at the video, and you'll see it, it's on YouTube and it's on my website. There's a bar. They tell you to, so we did 10 maneuvers. I did it in Star City, and you do 10 maneuvers, and every maneuver you go up at a vertical and you go down at a vertical, and when you're going up at those 40 degree angles, you get you experience twice the force of gravity, which is awful. It's an awful feeling on your body. And then as the plane turns, whoop, you go up for about 40 seconds. So the guy was telling us this in Russian, hadn't a clue what he was saying, and I was just told the lights will go down when you go into 2G, and that'll tell you to just stay still, and then the lights will come up, and then they have people that kind of help you, and they'll poke you, and off you go. And they were amazing. The things that other people were doing were incredible. But the first time we did the maneuver came up, they told us to hold the bar so that we'd have an idea of what it felt like. So we held the bar. And so for the rest of every single one of my maneuvers, bar one, I held the bar, and I didn't even know I was doing it. And that's typical of me. It's like testing my boundaries all the time. And I only realized about 12 hours later that I didn't have to hold the bar. Like I didn't, that was enough for me. The first six maneuvers, I had things to do as well, because I was bringing pictures this young boy did, and I have this doll that I bring. So I had homework to do. So I only got to play for the last four. But compared to other people, my flight was very tame. Like other people were like flying over me and doing tumble turns and all sorts of stuff. But I didn't vomit. And to me, that was a huge success. But it was really scary. I was really scared and then really happy. It's the weirdest thing. It's like a roller coaster. That's the best way to explain it. To put yourself in a situation where you're afraid and then realizing that, like, it's mad when your body hasn't a clue what's happening. I found that really interesting, because you kept thinking that you could master. You kept thinking that you could swim, or...
Is it like being underwater?
Yeah, it's like being underwater. But water, you can push against away. It. You keep thinking you can do that. And what I found amazing was you just literally have to go... And you're gonna move. Now, you won't move if you don't put energy in your body. So you stay on the ground if you don't actually kick off. But if you do anything at all, woo, and it takes a lot of skill to actually be able to control how to move. So I found it really interesting, and I'd love to do more of them. But again, it shows it showed me again the hours and hours of prep that astronauts put in to being able to live up there. And again, they never tell you. They never tell you.
Yeah. Niamh, how can people become part of your tribe and follow you?
Oh, I'd love that. You can subscribe on my website. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm always like reporting news and stuff on Twitter every day. And Instagram is more of my own personal stuff, my own personal kind of walking mission. And I do live streams on that. It's Niamh, which is my name, N-I-A-M-H. So it's like Dior for doctor, _Niamh_Shaw for Twitter and Instagram. And the Humans of Space podcast is up on all the platforms. My book, Dream Big, is, you can order that, I think, through all the international book online shops. And my YouTube channel.
But go to your local store.
Oh, absolutely. Go to your local store. Yeah. And ask for it, because it has an ISBN number and everything. Yeah. It's been published, so it should be available. Yeah. But and I want to hear from you, and I want to visit the world when the world opens up again. A big part of what I'm currently trying to do to meet all these new people is to visit different countries and use a network of people to make that happen in whatever way.
Wonderful. Niamh, at the end of our show, we usually have a fun tradition that is a quick shot of inspiration without much thinking.
Yeah.
From the world of science, from the world of space, the space industry, or whatnot. So don't overthink. What's your quick shot, your space espresso, I would say, you would love to share with me and the audience?
I think it's that perspective. It's that. So what I always say when I'm talking to people, if I get a chance to get up and if I'm lucky enough to get up and speak to people, you know, we have a tendency to see ourselves in our own little bubble. So right now I'm quarantining in this lovely part hotel in Strasbourg, and I can see the four walls, but I know I'm in Strasbourg. I can't draw Strasbourg, but I know I'm in Strasbourg, and I'm aware that Strasbourg is in Europe, as indeed you are as well, that occupies a certain amount of space on Earth. And I can choose to confine my thinking to this room, or I can choose to see it like a thread, and I'm here, but that thread goes all the way out beyond Earth, the solar system, the Milky Way, our neighbourhood of galaxies, our supercluster, Virgo supercluster, our local group of superclusters, and the 55 superclusters that make up the observable universe, mm-hmm. the edge of which is 46.6 billion light years from us right now. Mm-hmm. We're part of this soup. And what it does for me is it makes me realise that when I worry about the stupid stuff in life, I'm going, who are you? You're just like a blip, and you're nothing without the whole of humanity getting behind you. So don't stress the small stuff, and you have one life to live. So you may as well make it the best one there is, and stop worrying about getting it wrong, and just do something, move forward every day. That's what I try to say to myself.
Wonderful. Neef, thank you so much. That's so encouraging.
Thanks, Mark.
And thank you for your mission. So yes, thanks. thank you so much for taking the time.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
I like that honesty. And thanks to you guys out there for listening in today, wherever you are right now. If you have anything you'd like to share, you know we're happy to listen. Either use email, podcast@spacewatch.global, or go straight to the mothership, spacewatch.global, the global center for guaranteed unbiased space news. Spread the word if you like what we do. We're looking forward to the next episode, and damn, I would love to tell you who we got in front of the microphone for that one. This will definitely be another milestone of our little coffee house. Stay tuned. I'm looking forward to seeing you. Marcus, out.